From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. When's the last time you put something on layaway? What about hawking that diamond ring at the pawn shop? These are some of the harsh realities emerging in our struggling economy. In a few minutes, we're going to talk to a Detroit pawn shop owner, but first we'll turn to Keith Reed. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer and one of our regular contributors. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Farai, how's it going?
It's going okay for me, but, you know, domestic and international stock markets are still volatile. And it's also a time when a lot of people start looking for that holiday job, whether it's a student or whether it's somebody picking up a second job. You can be Santa's helper. You can be the one, you know, making sure that the stores are stocked up, but not so much right now. Retail just lost 40,000 jobs last month. It's the 10th month in a row when that sector has lost jobs. So people still want to buy. A lot of folks, though, have maxed out on their income, and there's something called layaway, which I certainly remember. Tell us what it is.
Well, I remember layaway, too. Layaway is essentially, it's almost the opposite of a credit card. If you have a credit card and you can borrow, you walk into a store, you plunk down your plastic, and you pay for it with that card, you basically borrow the money on the spot to buy what you want to buy, and you take it out of the store with you. With layaway, you go into a store and you say, I really like that TV, and I'll give you 10% down on the television, and I'll come back every week or every couple of weeks and put down more money on it until it's paid off. And the point at which it's paid off, you then carry that item out of the store. So it's a little bit more complicated of a transaction than is paying by credit card, but it also works out to be cheaper because you don't pay the more exorbitant interest rates that you would when you lay something away. You basically just pay a service fee of 10 or 15 bucks or some percentage of the item, and then you pay it off, and then it's yours.
So it sounds like, in a lot of ways, financially, layaway is a much better deal than carrying credit card debt. Why do you think people have become so reliant on using credit cards as the means to get something right away?
For two reasons. Number one, it's layaway is more financially better, probably for the majority of buyers, but it doesn't satisfy the instant gratification that we've become accustomed to. Once you've got a credit card in your pocket, again, the difference is you can walk into a store, get exactly what you want, as long as you have that money available on your credit card. If it's $1,500 or if it's $5, you can plunk the credit card down, you can pay, you can charge it, and then you worry about paying it off later. And it seems like it's a little bit easier to do it that way because, hey, you know, the credit card company will send you a bill instead of for $1,500, they'll send you a bill and you pay $100 every month. What you don't realize is that you're paying, you know, anywhere from, you know, 13 to 18, even 20 or 30%, depending on your interest rate on that purchase. So you pay a lot more over the long term, but you get what you want right up front, and it's instant gratification that people enjoy. With layaway, it's the opposite. You have to actually pay the entire thing off, that whole entire $1,500 or $2,000 or whatever the cost is of the item that you're buying before you take it home. Layaway is also something that stores don't like to do or haven't liked to do for a long time because a store obviously wants to get all of its money up front. They don't want to hold something in inventory when they can be bringing in a new item that they can sell to somebody else if they've got to keep, you know, 10% or 15% of their store's inventory in the back waiting for somebody to come in over the course of a month or two to pay it off. Obviously, their ability to bring in new merchandise and to sell it to somebody else is affected. And they like to realize their revenue right up front, not over the course of a couple of months.
Is there an upside to the era of layaway coming back? I mean, it sounds as if layaway is something where you got it or you don't got it, meaning by the time you walk out of the store, you either had the money to pay for this or you didn't have the money to pay for it, and it's still left in the store, as opposed to credit cards, which make you think, well, I think I have the money to pay for this and I'll pay for it later. You know, is there a kind of sober realism that actually is positive for people in the return of this kind of method of buying gifts for the holidays, say, as opposed to the credit card method?
Yeah, I think so. Somebody asked me about a week or so ago, and he said, what do you think the biggest change is going to need to be for young professionals, for our generation coming along economically. And I said, the biggest change is really going to have to be that you're going to have to wean, or we are going to have to wean ourselves off credit almost entirely. I mean, with the exception of making a major big ticket purchase like a home or a car or something that you absolutely can't afford to pay for in cash. People are going to have to just start to learn to live within their means and find ways of paying cash, even if it's paying cash over time for the items that they want, not buying things on credit, not buying shares of stocks on margin, not borrowing and paying interest on purchases that they make. To the extent that layaway facilitates that, then I think it's a positive thing. But then there's another school of thought that goes, listen, if you need to lay something away, you probably should just save for it anyway and walk into the store and pay cash. And I don't really think that layaway is gonna become as popular as it was if you go back a few decades or even back just 15 years or so. Stores still are in the business of wanting their money up front. Shareholders demand to see that the revenues are coming in. And when you start to see people laying more things away as opposed to paying for things up front, the stores aren't happy with that. So there's a limit to how far this can go.
One thing that happens is you see people doing layaway around the holidays, trying to get those Christmas gifts. There has increasingly been numbers of families who are debating whether or not you should even be giving gifts at a time like this. Maybe, you know, something small and token, but like not that huge gift that you normally would give. How do you have that debate within a family without it turning crazy? Because there are times when, you know, you have people getting all upset, but of course we have to give a gift to everybody in the family. And there's none of this, like one gift per family, or none of this pull out of a hat. And other people are like, well, I grew up pulling out of the hat. Pulling out of the hat is fine. You know, there's all these different theories about how you give gifts. So how do you deal with that on a very practical finance level when people start thinking about holidays coming up?
I think this holiday season and really the next few months, again, are going to be It's just going to be sobering for a lot of people. There is a point at which people are going to begin to realize how far above their means they have been living for a long time. And I don't think that people are truly ready to accept that. But I think as the economy tightens and more people start to lose jobs and it just becomes more and more difficult to borrow and interest rates go up on credit cards, people are going to start to realize that, you know, we can't buy everybody and their mama and their cousins and their kids a gift for Christmas. It's got to be, we got to do for our kids. We got to do immediate family and one or two other people. And we got to pay for it all in cash. So whatever you can do or whatever we can do to afford that has to be it. So that's going to be a little bit of pain. I mean, you can make it fun. You can do things like you said, go back to pulling out of the hat, have the kids pull out of the hat, do more family gatherings where everybody brings something to eat and talks and watches a movie as opposed to everybody coming over with $100 or $200 gift for everybody in your family. There's all kinds of different ways that you can do it. I mean, I grew up in a family that didn't have a lot of money and everybody didn't get a gift from everybody else every year. Or if you got something, maybe you got something smaller. And that's not a bad thing. And that's probably the type of thing that you're going to see people reverting to this year, but not without some pain and probably not without some arguing between some husbands and wives and some cousins and some mamas and some big mamas and some of everybody else, too.
Let's throw the government into it. Congress is considering another multi-billion-dollar stimulus package, and the Fed chief backs it. But let's say that taxpayers do get another stimulus check. Is that going to go into things like consumer goods, or are people going to throw that straight at the credit card bills or into the savings accounts? You know, explain the patterns that people seem to have in taking these stimulus checks, which are meant to be spent, or from the government's perspective, would stimulate the economy if they were spent, and what people actually do with them.
Well, let me take a step back and say that a lot of people, a lot of economists think that another, just like the first one, that another stimulus check is just a red herring, because of course the government is doing a lot of borrowing and making a lot of promises for a lot of money to be given to Wall Street, to be given to the mortgage industry, to be given to homeowners who are in trouble, and just, you know, coming up with another few hundred dollars check to stimulate the economy a little bit more is just robbing Peter to pay Paul. That said, I find it a little bit interesting that in talking to some blog readers and some people who I just sort of kind of casually polled and asked, what would you do with another stimulus check? The answers were very, very different than what they were a few months ago. Then it was, you know, probably 60-40 in favor of taking that money and running out to buy something that you hadn't been able to buy, and, you know, worrying about the rest later, or, you know, hey, I'm still getting the tax return anyway, so this is cool. I can take a little bit of this money and you know, purchase something and pay some bills off later. This time around, almost no one that I asked that question to came back and said, you know what, I'm really looking forward to a TV, or I know that that clothes going to be on sale this year around Christmas time, or, you know, I'm looking forward to buying something. Everybody that I talked to said, I'm going to take that money and put it in savings. I'm going to take that money and pay a bill. I'm going to pay down all my credit cards. And I think that's an indication of where the economy is and where people's consumer confidence is now in the country.
Keith, you know, just quickly, isn't that exactly what the government doesn't want?
That is exactly what the government doesn't want, but it's probably what we need. I mean, I think it's, you know, we have to get to a point, honestly, Virai, where people start to say, you know, we live in a society that is based far too much on consumerism and far too much on consumption. I mean, a lot of the fundamentals of what's happened to us, you know, remember, the fundamentals of the economy are strong, right? No, they're not strong when everybody is borrowing to buy stuff so that they can borrow to buy more stuff. It gets mm-hmm. to a point where it is just simply not sustainable anymore for the bulk of economic activity or for the core of what keeps the economy afloat to be people borrowing money to pay for things.
Right.
It's just not.
I'm going to go ahead and jump in because we're going to keep talking. I'm going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about pawn shops and the industry making a comeback. What does that really say about where we are? So, Keith, hang on. And we're going to talk about that. Plus, ahead, the mother and brother of Academy Award-winning actress Jennifer Hudson were found shot to death last week in Chicago, and they fear a young child found dead could be her missing nephew as well. We are back with reporter and economics expert Keith Reed, and we've been talking about trends in retail, including the revival of layaway plans. But we're also seeing pawn shops getting a lot more business. We're going to bring a new voice into the conversation. Tony Aubrey is a successful pawn shop owner in Detroit, Michigan. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing great. So just making the point that Keith is still with us as well. But Tony,
I'm
going to start with you. I've been reading all these stories about high traffic into pawn shops. If there's tough times, people seem to want to sell. And, you know, certainly if you want a good deal on something, you might want to go by and see what's there. You're in Detroit. It's been hit so hard by auto industry issues, foreclosures. What are people pawning when they come into you?
You know, for our industry, I've been in this a long time, and our industry has changed over the last several years, mostly due to inflation and unemployment locally. You know, as you said, the Detroit area has been hit very hard. We're on the east side of Detroit, just north of Detroit. We have two locations, one in an auto city called Warren, Michigan, and then the other one is in Roseville. So we get a lot of Wayne, Macomb, and Oakland County folks. And what's happening, the biggest change that I see over the years is the dollar amount has changed, the demand has changed, because now most families, if they're fortunate to have two-person income, they're struggling, could be several reasons. The subprime crisis obviously took a big hit on homeowners. The gasoline situation in the last few months, I can't tell you how many people every day come in and say, I need $100 extra a week now because to go back and forth to work for both parties, you know, the husband and the wife or what have you. It's a big burden on the average family, and we're seeing people pawning their more expensive items. We kind of specialize in larger loans. We do fine jewelry. We do automotive, ATVs, fishing boats, large tools, musical instruments.
So that is, yeah, significant amounts. Let me ask you this. On an emotional level, do you ever feel, wow, somebody just came in here with a broken heart, and what I'm doing is, it's legal. It may even help them in some ways, but it's also a function of heartbreak. How can you operate?
To be honest with you, we feel pretty good about what we do because most of our business is loaning people money. 80% of those people come back. So we know we helped 80% of those people because they needed a short-term loan for whatever, make a house payment, utility payment, car payment, unexpected emergency. So most of the time, and that's kind of the national average, to be honest with you, most of the time it's to help the local person who needs a short-term loan.
Keith, from your perspective, if you were to talk to someone about their options, let's just do a scenario. There's someone who, for any number of reasons, really is not going to make their mortgage or their rent unless they do something serious. And they have that family's, set of electric guitars, something that, that might go well at a pawn shop. What other options would they have, Keith, besides pawning those items? And when would it be a good idea for them to do it versus not doing it?
Well, I think you got to start before you get to the point that you've started to pawn your family's items. A lot of times people get desperate and they start to think of the easy, the quick fix solution. And this is not to belittle what Tony's doing in his business, but it is to say that if you've not called your mortgage company to see whether or not you can work out a payment plan, to see if there's something that you can do to try to stay in your house, then ultimately going to the pawn shop and getting a short-term loan to be able to pay back that money that you owe the mortgage company is only going to help you for a short period of time, and you're not going to end up out of the situation that you need to be out of. What you need to do is start to think more long-term about what your options are. Now, if you get to the point where you're desperate and you absolutely positively have to generate some cash, of course, one of the things that you want to do is look at maybe some social services agencies. It's possible for you to get some help with your utility bills. Maybe not, of course, your mortgage, but there is help that's out there to get some help, some other short term help with other things. But I think the idea is that you want to try to make some arrangements to keep yourself out of long term trouble before you have to resort to selling the things or borrowing against the things that you have in your household.
Tony, do people come in just wanting to sell things? Because I certainly, from what I know about pawn shops, think of them as places where you can you put something up and then you can get it back if you pay off the interest. But do people come in just saying, hey, I just want to sell this straight out, and it's more of a consignment shop model?
Typically, most people do want a loan because they want the option of retrieving their merchandise. However, I would say we're about 25% of the people that come in, they do sell because they do get more money. They just sell it outright because they're taking advantage of the high gold market or what have you. That's been a big influx lately because of the gold prices. So a lot of people had a lot of extra jewelry laying around. So if they dispose of the jewelry and gold being at high, it was a significant amount of cash to them. But, yes, we do both. We buy and we loan also.
What's the mood that you see? And, Keith, I'm going to ask you to wrap this up in a second. But before we let you go, Tony, what's the mood of people who perhaps were hoping for things to turn around? I mean, I have people who I know very dearly in the Detroit area, and it's rough. It's rough to think about, winter jobs coming back. So what's the mood when people walk into your store?
Well, surprisingly, most of the people, they're praying and hoping that things turn around quickly, as of all of us do. But, people from Detroit, they're kind of they're spirited, very tough, and they try to look at the bright side, and hopefully this automotive and generally the economy just turns around sooner than later. And I got to say, I'm surprised. I've had some people, that have a serious home issue where they need a large amount of money because of the subprime issue, and You know, they come in and they leave with the money with a smile on their face. It's kind of, it is heart-wrenching, and hopefully for everyone it turns around soon.
Keith, just to take it home, what should you think of when you're making a decision? You're basically faced with the decision, how do I get money fast? What should be the question in your mind about decisions that you make?
The question in your mind should be, what are the long-term implications going to be? Because there are many options out there for people to get money very quickly, to run right out. You can do payday loans. You can go to a pawn shop. There's all different kinds of short-term borrowing. But you really need to think what the long-term cost is going to be to you, whether if you go to a pawn shop and you turn in that guitar or that wedding ring or that television, are you actually going to be able to get it back? Are you actually going to be able to afford the interest on it? And what would the consequences be if you're not able to go back and get it? Are you really willing to lose that item? If you go to a payday loan shop and you get a payday loan and you need some money right now, but you're going to end up paying more interest than you can actually afford to pay back, and in many instances that becomes the case, what's going to happen? Are you going to fall into this trap where you're paying back more and more and more debt than you ever would have needed to incur? That's mm-hmm. the thing that you need to think before you go out and look into some of these short-term options that you have to borrow for quick cash.
All right. Well, Tony and Keith, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
We've been talking to Tony Aubrey, owner of Motor City Pawn in Detroit, Michigan, and Keith Reed, reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. He joined us from member station WVXU in Cincinnati, Ohio. Oscar-winning actress Jennifer Hudson faces a family tragedy and questions about whether neighbors should have done more. Plus, what looked like a racial incident on the campaign trail is now looking like a hoax. On today's Bloggers Roundtable, we've got Anthony Bradley, creator of the Institute blog, Kay Tempest Bradford of the Angry Black Woman blog, and Corey Richardson, who blogs at vexedinthecity.wordpress.com. Hi, folks.
Hi there.
So let's start out with this horrible tragedy that people are paying attention to around the world through the internet, through all sorts of different ways. Jennifer Hudson, she went from being an American Idol contestant to an Oscar winner for Dreamgirls. But on Friday, her mother, Darnell Donerson, and brother, Jason Hudson, were found shot to death in their Chicago home. Now, Hudson's 7-year-old nephew had gone missing. Police have found a boy's body in the back of an SUV that they were looking for in a manhunt, but they have not identified the body. A lot of people think that it is probably the Hudson boy. Now, the estranged husband of Jennifer Hudson's sister had been questioned in the killings, but they have not charged him in the crime. That man spent 7 years in prison for attempted murder, vehicular hijacking, possession of a stolen vehicle. Now, there's so many angles to this. Let me start with the family angle. Tempest, Jennifer was willing to give her mom money to move, but her mother, you know, has roots and wanted to stay in the neighborhood. What is it? Is this yet another example that you cannot fix other people's lives, that your plan for other people's lives and for keeping them safe is something that may be unworkable? And what must it mean to this young actress that, you know, she tried and it this unfolded?
Yeah, it's such a terrible, you know, situation. And it is true that, you know, when even if you have personally achieved success and you want to, you know, get your mother, get your family out of the neighborhood where you grew up, that may not necessarily be the best neighborhood, it doesn't surprise me that there would be still some people who are reluctant to leave. You know, the reports I read said that her mother just had a lot of ties to that neighborhood. And I can relate, you know, the neighborhood that my grandmother lived in, and I spent a lot of my childhood, and it's not the best neighborhood right now, but, you know, we have roots there. We want to stay. But, you know, could that lead to something, you know, along the lines of this? Maybe. But I like to choose to think that, you know, there are, that it can get better, that, you know, the neighborhood would go back to being the way it was when I was growing up. And perhaps Jennifer's mother felt the same way. Perhaps she felt secure there because she knew the neighborhood.
Anthony, let me read you a little something from the Chicago Sun-Times columnist Richard Roper. He said, sadly, gunshots are so commonplace in that area that even though neighbors heard gunshots at 9 a.m., nobody called police. A family member found Donerson in the living room around 3 p.m. and called for police, who found the second victim in a bedroom in the house. For all the years I've lived in the Chicago area and for all the years I will live here, it will probably be this way. We're all in the same time in the same place, but within that place, there are parallel worlds. First off, people not calling the police when they hear gunshots. Do the neighbors bear any responsibility or burden for just not paying attention or not thinking that this was worthy of comment?
Well, one of the things this reminds us is that the state of affairs in the neighborhood was so bad that gunshots is sadly seen as simply background noise. It's sort of like screeching tires or car engines or sirens. And sadly, we see a case where if neighbors actually called the police whenever there was gunshots, the phones would be ringing off the hook. And what happens is that because gunshots have become standard sort of background noise, no one actually acts until they actually see a body. Because gunshots are simply a part of everyday life. And that's really part of the deeper tragedy here.
There's this other aspect, the parallel lives, which is that, you know, we can all operate in the same time and space, and yet you never really know what's happening in someone else's life. And, of course, when you take that to the level of celebrity, Corey, you have this woman who is in The Secret Life of Bees, who now has this Oscar, who has a new album that's doing really well. What do you think are appropriate reactions by fans? And what I mean by that is that we live in a world where you can contact celebrities through, you know, MySpace, Facebook, you know, through their agents' offices, all these things. When, you know, any time I've seen a story online about this, there are posts on message boards. But beyond that, what do you think is fair game in terms of responding as a fan or a supporter? And what do you think is off limits?
Well, I think that, you know, it really is up to the person in question who has been the victim. Or, you know, is associated with the victim of the crime or the tragedy, you know. So if Jennifer Hudson were to say that, you know, and don't send me cards, don't send me flowers, donate to an anti-violence charity, or don't, you know, I don't, you know, don't just send me a message, but, you know, let's use this instead of just a moment of personal tragedy, but also a time of collective reflection as to, you know, what's going on in our neighborhoods. I think that's one way of looking at it. In terms of from the side of the fans, you know, it's like watching anyone else that you know experiencing something, you know, horrible, and you don't quite know what exactly is the right thing to do because people respond differently. You know, in this case, I guess because of where we are now in our society and that we are ultimately voyeuristic and that line between what's, you know, what's off limits and what's within bounds with our celebrities, you know, we have Bossip, we have Perez Hilton, we have all these different sites that you can go to and find out so much that we almost have this personal kinship and connection with celebrities. And so people feel like, wow, if that happens to so-and-so, it's almost like it happened to me. And so therefore I gotta write a card. I gotta send a letter. I gotta send some flowers or something.
Well, we, like everyone else, want to send out our thoughts to the family, and it's just one of those things that it's a real tragedy. We are going to go ahead and take a break, but I want all of you guys to stay with us because we have plenty of other things to talk about, including politics. So next on News and Notes, we have more from our bloggers. Plus, when gospel meets the spirit of competition, it's called the How Sweet the Sound Tour, and we'll tell you more. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Welcome back to our Bloggers Roundtable. Today we are talking with Anthony Bradley, creator of the Institute blog, Kay Tempest Bradford of the Angry Black Woman blog, and Corey Richardson, who blogs at vexedinthecity.wordpress.com. So I'm going to keep on trucking and talk about the case of the McCain mutilation, maybe, is that, that's what we'll call it. Last week, a 20-year-old McCain volunteer reported to the police she was attacked by a robber at an ATM machine in Philadelphia. She said the robber got angry when she saw that she had a John McCain bumper sticker on her car, proceeded to punch her in the back of the head, pin her down, and carve the letter B into her cheek. And you can see on our website, News and Views, nprnewsandviews.org, a picture of her with a black eye and this bee, this reddened bee on her cheek. She said that the suspect told her, "You're going to be a Barack Obama supporter." Well, later this girl admitted she made up the entire story. She had described her attacker as a 6'4" black man wearing shiny shoes. Tempest, why do you think somebody would go ahead and run a hoax like this?
Well, mainly because it speaks to an unfortunately sort of archetypal fright that people have, but I guess more accurately it'd be white people. I mean, because she's drawing on very specific and well-known stereotypes. A large black man attacks a young white woman, oh noes. And it's such a familiar narrative that it doesn't surprise me that this, when she concocted this plan, that this is the first thing that came to her mind. And in another time, she would have been believed without question. But as somebody on the ABW blog pointed out, this is because of the internet, because of the way that news and information like this moves, that it was like really easy to disprove. It was really skeptical to begin with. And it's sort of like an old media smear campaign. So, yeah.
So what you're saying is that in addition to everything else, she didn't do a good job at trying to hoax people.
No, definitely not. Because she said that she was at an ATM. All ATMs have cameras. So it was really easy to prove that no one came up to her while she was standing at the ATM. She carved the B into her face backwards and upside down and badly. And it didn't. And just in general, it just didn't seem like something that somebody would do. Muggers don't generally tend to make political statements.
Corey, let me go to you. The executive vice president of Fox News wrote on his blog before the woman admitted she made up the story, "If the incident turns out to be a hoax, Senator McCain's quest for the presidency is over, forever linked to race baiting." Now, of all the things that would link a campaign to race baiting, I'm not sure that this is the one. But why do you think the vice president of Fox would have chosen this as this kind of line in the sand?
I think that, at this point, really, that was the moment that the McCain campaign jumped the shark. That was the exact time when just everyone looked at the McCain campaign and was just like, oh, this is nothing more than a confederacy of dunces and a serious string of inexplicable errors.
But it's not like the McCain campaign hired this woman. They didn't.
No. And the problem is not John McCain. The problem is his campaign. The problem is that there are people around him who would use this as some type of, again, line in the sand and go, see how these Obama supporters are? You can't trust these Obama supporters. They're a bunch of thugs. And then there's other people who would look at this and think, okay, well, we saw this before with Susan Smith. You just blame a black guy. You say he's 6'4". When I heard the description of the alleged mugger, I was like, I think I know that guy. He described half of my friends. So, I just think that at that point, it had reached such a tenor of silliness and such a point of just absurdity that, when the Fox News vice president says it'll reach, talked about the race baiting and all that, he was just saying that now it's officially gotten that dumb.
Anthony, let me go to Anthony. There was that time when some of Senator Obama's volunteers hustled along these Muslim women so that they wouldn't be in a camera shot. And that got a lot of concerned commentary this summer. Of course, there was an apology. You haven't heard as much from the Obama side of there being incidents that cross a line verbally, but there have been, from supporters things that definitely are in questionable taste at best. One of them is that in West Hollywood, there is a Halloween prop in the front yard, a couple of guys who have a mannequin dressed as Sarah Palin hanging by a noose. They have a whole little explanation on video sort of saying, well, it is a Halloween month and we wouldn't do this in any other month, and we wouldn't have done it with a black male mannequin, that doing it with a white female mannequin is different. How do you buy into something like that where you've got a Sarah Palin figure hanging by a noose?
Well, it just reminds us that people in our country have some real serious issues. I mean, the woman in this hoax had some mental problems that related to this, and also for these guys out in California, what you find is that people, for some strange reason, have chosen these images of violence to somehow communicate some of their own political positions. Now, what's interesting about this particular news situation is the idea that it's sort of art. The guy said that it's sort of Halloween and spooky. Is quite questionable because Halloween, typically Halloween costumes will be about fictional characters or people that it passed on for generations. And because this guy is doing it at his private residence, I mean, he does have some freedom to do that. But I actually am okay with the fact that we live in a country where people can be free to do things like this. It's one of the trade-offs with respect to being this free, that people are free to do really dumb and stupid things, and that's something that we have to actually sadly bear the cost of.
Tempest, there's also something else. Governor Palin still answering questions about the $150,000 in clothes that the party lent to her and her family. Is this something that people should be scrutinizing, or is this just a small issue at a time when we should be thinking about the issues of governance, as opposed to, well, what is she wearing and will she return it on time?
Right. I definitely agree that this is a really stupid thing to be focusing on. I mean, I can understand it a little bit if it is in the context of how is the McCain campaign spending their money, spending the Republican National Party's money on the different campaign things. But at the same time, nobody is asking about, as someone pointed out in an op-ed piece, nobody's asking about John McCain's, you know, shoes that cost over $500, and, you know, how much is his wardrobe costing, and how much is his hair and makeup costing, because, you know, he doesn't have a lot of hair, but somebody does it. So it's a dumb thing to focus on, really, and it really just speaks to the whole sexism thing that has been going on since this campaign started. You know, they did it to Hillary, they're doing it to Sarah Palin in a different way, but it really just comes down to nobody has questioned, you know, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, or John McCain on their hair and makeup costs, but they're questioning Sarah Palin. I'm no fan of hers, but this is kind of ridiculous.
All right, on that note, we're going to have to wrap it up. We're getting so close. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Farai.
No problem. Thank you.
We were talking to Anthony Bradley, creator of the Institute blog, who joined us from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. Kay Tempest Bradford of the Angry Black Woman blog joined us from our NPR studios in New York. And Corey Richardson of the blog Vexed in the City joined us from KUT in Austin, Texas. In the 1990s, a new crop of young music directors changed gospel music as we know it. They fused the traditional large choir sound with elements of hip-hop and R&B. Donald Lawrence came out of that period. His work with the Tri-City Singers made him one of the biggest names in gospel, and he's done solo work as well. NPR's Tony Cox found him in a new role, hosting How Sweet the Sound, a showcase for gospel choirs around the country.
Now, is this sort of an American Idol for gospel choirs? Is that what it is?
For lack of a better term, I would say, yeah. But, you know, the difference, I think, would be it's more about recognizing and saluting the church choir as opposed to a competition of who's going to be the best. When you really get to the show and you see and you feel the energy and you feel the emotion of it, it's really all about just saying thank you for being in the choirs and really sacrificing your time and keeping great gospel music going on Sunday mornings in churches across the country. So really everybody was a winner. And I know that's a cliche, but really honestly, where everybody that was in it got some type of financial compensation, whether they want or not.
Really? Now, what's the biggest choir you've ever been involved with or heard or seen or had to judge?
When it comes to the biggest choir I've seen or worked with, it would be when I was really a kid and I did presented one of my first songs to the national public at the Gospel Music Workshop of America. It was the Mass Choir. And the Mass Choir was literally about 2,000 people. So many people that they could only put half of the choir on the stage to do half of the concert. And that choir would exit and then the other half of the choir would come back and do the other side of the concert.
2,000 people in one choir?
One choir. Yes, I was petrified. I was really a little kid, and I was petrified.
You know, you've long been associated with the Tri-City Singers going back to the early 90s, and you've had great success with them, even when the group finally retired some years ago with a monster live recording. Was that bittersweet? Good music, but the end of a...
You know what? It was bittersweet, but I think it's wisdom, and I think you have to know when you need to transition, because I think sometimes when you don't transition at the right time, you end up dying in a season or just kind of becoming stagnant in a season. So I felt like this was the time for all of us to transition. I'm doing so many things to really, really kind of maintenance a choir right now at this particular point in my career was really hard.
You know, you went solo yourself a few years back. You knocked it out of the park with your very first recording, I Speak Life.
Yeah.
I think it won 6 out of 7 stellar awards
it was nominated for.
Congratulations on that,
Thank you very much. I appreciate
it. You had some great talent with you. But what's it like to go solo like that after having been associated with a group like Tri-City for so long?
You know what? It's a little scary at first. You know, I've kind of been doing it now for about 4 years, so I'm kind of used to it. But the one thing is you look back and you don't see the same faces behind you, you know, because I have 9 session singers that I kind of call the company that go out and do vocals with me when I'm out on the road. But when you're used to seeing 35 people wrapped in all this eclectic garb and wear, and you don't see them in there anymore, and it's people that you've known for years, because they are singers and Tri-City Singers that I grew up with. So they're people that I've known since I was probably 10, you know. So when you don't see them anymore and you just got this certain kind of chemistry, you have to redevelop that chemistry with new people. And luckily I've been able to get that going now. It was a little frightening.
I see you smiling. Let's talk about this for a moment, because people like you, Kirk Franklin, I'll throw in, let's say, Fred Hammond, John P. Key, for example, are contemporary artists who sometimes will use a variation of what we'll call the old call and response in gospel music. And in some of your songs, you'll say something or talk, and then the choir will back you up lyrically. What does that do for a song, though? Does it give you more opportunity for expression when you do it that way?
It's a takeoff of what James Cleveland used to do back in the day. I really, really do feel like that. We just do a contemporary way of doing it. But when I first started doing it, I didn't do it because I didn't want to sing. I did it because I wanted to stress the lyric that the choir was doing. I wanted everybody to hear this great lyric that we're saying. And sometimes they lose it when it's melodic. And if someone would say it before they sing it melodic, you kind of get a double hit of what the lyric is. So for me, I might even not say what they're saying, but I'll say something that really ignites the line or the phrase even more. So it just hits home with everybody.
You talked about contemporary. One of the things, you have had music on the dance charts and you've had music on the gospel charts.
Uh-huh.
I would think, and I want to get your response to this, that nowadays it's not as difficult to balance music between secular and non-secular as it used to be.
See, one thing I've always felt is a great song is just a great song. You know, sometimes there have been a lot of great songs that people just weren't exposed to. They would have done the same thing then if they had been exposed to it. So me, I don't think it's really hard to balance it one way or the other. I just think that if it's a great song, it just goes there and people enjoy it, you know.
Well, your music, some of it, it's, I would call it, it's danceable.
It's a feeling. It's uplifting. It's empowering. And I think who doesn't want to be uplifted in a world, in a society that we live in now? So, you know.
What about this new music? So you're just coming out of the studio?
Yeah. Yeah. So we did a live record, and I did it with my nine session singers. And it was done live at my church. And it's the first time I've done a live record myself without Tri-City. So this to me, even more than I Speak Life, is very groundbreaking, or really sets the tone for where I go next. I think it's a great idea. It's called The Law of Confession. And it was built around a book that my pastor, Pastor Bill Winston, is doing. So it's kind of like the soundtrack to the book. The new single is called Back to Eden, and it's still from this series, and it's the same kind of concept thing. It's the thing that a quick definition would be: when God made us, he deemed us to live in a life of abundance and a life of great family. When we fail, we lost that right, but Jesus came and he redeemed us. That's where you get the word redeem. So I'm telling everybody, let's get back to Eden and live on top of the world.
Yeah, sing it to somebody. Tell them how it is, y'all.
Our family's blessed.
Our family's blessed.
Finances blessed.
Our finances blessed.
Our mind is
speed. This has been a great conversation. I want to end it with this question. When you graduated from the prestigious Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, where did you see yourself, Donald Lawrence, going at that time, and how close have you come to it?
That's a great question. I saw myself being on Broadway. I did not see myself on records. I had no idea about the record business, doing records. I knew I always wanted to do a gospel album at some point, but my main focus was to be on Broadway, singing and dancing and doing musical theater. That was my goal. How close am I to it now? I don't know, because records and theater is something else. However, I am in negotiations with taking a show to New York. So we'll see. We'll see what the future holds.
That was NPR's Tony Cox talking with gospel artist and producer Donald Lawrence. His upcoming CD is called The Law of Confession. He joined us here at NPR West. And that's our show for today. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.